Right. Welcome, everybody, to Overlanding 101. Today we're going to talk about vehicle choice.
Very important topic.
I think we should probably avoid specific brands more and more, talk more about vehicle types.
Vehicle types and tips on what you'd actually look at when you're going to select a vehicle.
Right.
You know, there's a big choice of vehicles these days, and it narrows down a lot depending on what you're going to use the vehicle for.
So maybe that, okay, so that's the first thing one would look for. You would have to ask, what am I going to use it for? Yeah. Weekend, 4x4 trails, off-road, weekend exploration.
Is it going to be a vehicle that you're going to share, you know, for work as well as kitting it out?
That's true, yes.
Because that, the setup is very different. Right. So I think the key thing for someone, this is an expense, this is your biggest expense, single expense on going overlanding. You know, if you're not hiring a vehicle, you're investing in buying a vehicle, then you're furthermore going to invest in what you do with the vehicle, kitting it out and equipment you buy.
Right.
So getting this right is really important.
So our advice would be, make sure you know what you want to do with the vehicle.
I think talk to enough people to understand and look long term. What are you going to use this vehicle for? You know, because a lot of people will buy a vehicle for their needs here and now, and down the road they find, well, those change. And it's always a compromise. You're never going to get the perfect vehicle for every scenario. That I've learned over many years.
Right.
But work the best scenario to minimize the compromise.
Okay. Would you say it would be a good idea to buy, for example, let's paint a picture. For example, if you want to go overlanding, you want to do some, and what I mean by that is you want to drive long distance, perhaps across different countries, but long distance, camp out of the vehicle and be away for a week, 2 weeks, a couple of months.
Yeah, I would say
let's paint
distance,
that picture.
Yeah, the picture would be,
would you buy, my question really says, based on that, would you buy a vehicle that's already built up, somebody's already used it, or would you start from scratch and build it up yourself?
That's a good question. It depends on what you want out of it. A lot of people will be happy to go and buy a vehicle that someone else has put the thought into. You know, you can get a lot of very good used vehicles that someone has done a trip in, invested a lot of money. Now, when someone's done a long year, 6 months, full-time overland trip, the vehicle's going to be fairly well looked after, but quite tired. You know, the components have had a lot of hard use. It's been a heavily laden vehicle going over a lot of bad roads for them to explore. So if you're buying a vehicle like that, you need to understand that you're going to need to invest money in refurbishing a lot of the mechanical components, which is absolutely fine.
Wouldn't you have to do that anyway if you're buying a used vehicle?
Well, if you're buying any used vehicle, you're going to, yes, you would. But certain components, like the shock absorbers, let's say, if it's just done a big trip, you're going to invest in new shock absorbers. If you bought a second-hand vehicle, you'd be putting new in anyway. So yes, it swings in roundabouts. There's no cheap way around this. Some of the scenarios that I look at is, if I can understand where you're going to take the vehicle. So someone comes to me and says, I'm going to do an overland trip and I want to go for a year. Then I'm very, very sure that, where are you going to go with your vehicle? What countries are you going to see? What spares are available in that country? How good are you mechanically, your mechanical knowledge? Because that's going to be a key factor in you looking after your vehicle, as opposed to you relying on workshops that may be good, some are brilliant, and some are really bad news. So you're in the hands of someone else looking after your car if you haven't got the mechanical knowledge.
Right.
And you should have that knowledge. We'll talk more about that later on. But
so the vehicle choice should be...
You want a really good, solid, simple... reliable vehicle if you are...
So having mechanical knowledge is very important for overlanding, so the vehicle choice should be based on a vehicle that is easy to understand and not too complicated.
You know, the electronics on the vehicles are fairly complex, but a lot of them are quite reliable and solid, and you can't get around electronics on vehicles unless you're going for a very, very old car. And these days people like to get a balance between a car which is not too old, because you're investing a lot of money into the car. So you don't want to go and spend a lot of money on this vehicle and it's 30 years old. But equally, there were some vehicles that were made, you know, that were simple, reliable and well used in, like, let's say Africa. You get spares on these vehicles all through Africa. So it would be a good choice to say, I'm going to choose a vehicle where I know I can get spares for this vehicle If it's simple, I can learn the basics of the mechanics and I can be hands-on in maintaining my vehicle or understand what needs to be done. So that would be important. But you've got to ask questions.
I also think that the choice of vehicle, I see people wanting to, you know, do something different. For example, they'll buy an unusual vehicle like a Larder or I'm trying to think of something else that is equally kind of interesting, but don't make good overland vehicles. And I'm talking brands here, but because they're unusual.
But you see an unusual
vehicle. You can't
vehicle
get spares.
Like, exactly. So
and
that's
then
your, that's
you
your,
want a set of springs for it. Oh, you want to get some information. What's the best springs for a what's it? And hardly anybody's got them.
Yeah.
So now you can't get good advice for them because so actually being ordinary and buying a...
If you're buying a sort of more well-used vehicle, or let's say
popular,
a well-recognized vehicle.
Really popular.
You're
going to
find there are components available for it. So one of the questions, and you've just hit the nail on the head, can you get spares for this vehicle? Not just mechanical parts. Can you get accessories you're going to bolt onto this car? If you're going to want to fit a winch, do they make a winch bumper for it?
Mm.
And you're quickly going to understand your trip is about going on a long trip for 6 months to a year. So you're investing your time and effort in a vehicle that's going to be simple, reliable, and you're going to put the best money you've got into the right components that you prioritize.
Mm.
And that's key, because a lot of people spend money on work that's done on the car, which is probably not necessary or probably an overkill.
But you mentioned earlier, rightly so, that some people will build an overland vehicle for short trips.
Yeah.
The same thing applies.
No, it does. You know, some people, for a lot of folk, having a vehicle like this is part of a lifestyle. We're identifying with a lifestyle. It's a hobby. It's an interest. It's an investment. Not everyone's got the luxury of taking 6 months or a year off to go on a nice extended overland trip. But they would like to have and can afford to have a really nice vehicle sitting there, and they could go and drive, well, like what we're doing, the Canning Stock Route, 3 weeks out, and that's their trip for a year. And they'll invest their money in building a really nice vehicle. And that's fantastic, because the vehicle is going to sit there fully kitted, ready to do a trip.
Mm.
The tough questions come when you're trying to compromise on using the vehicle for daily runarounds, and then you want to add the equipment in to go away, because your safety elements, as we probably will discuss in more detail, tires and suspension, critical components, and these are geared around how much weight you're going to put in the car. Well, the suspension is for sure.
Mm.
Choice of tires, you know, spending money on really good quality tires. So I always try and get people to start off by finding someone, if they're looking at a used vehicle, who can help them go through a vehicle thoroughly. To know, for one, they're not buying a car that has got a bad history, it's full of rust, it's been abused by...
Maybe in an accident or something like
accident,
that.
It's been an accident, or it's been a towing, or it's been at the sea where there's a lot of rust in. So, first of all, you want to make sure you're buying the best option of a vehicle.
Right.
You don't really want to do much body work to it, that's expensive. Your gearbox work's expensive. And, you know, drivetrain you want in good condition as best you can.
How important, and I would say is very important, is a service history?
You know, service history, is you can take it with a pinch of salt. Because vehicles, if you get a vehicle that's relatively new, the last 10 years, you might get a good service history. And if it's been to main dealer, it'll have a very accurate service history. For a lot of people, a service history, unless they're fastidious at keeping the receipts, I wipe the slate clean when I start with the car. I basically take a second-hand vehicle and I go through the vehicle with a fine-tooth comb. We'll strip down all the components we know that are problems.
So what would you recommend? Somebody has seen a vehicle and it interests them and it has a part service history, which is probably the most common. What critical things can they look at that gives them an indication or otherwise that the vehicle has been well cared for?
The key things for me is that I look at how well someone's looked after the car.
How do you tell? That's my question.
So wear on the seats, how clean the car is, how well presented it is to you. Is the engine clean? Some people go and they fastidiously clean the car and then they sell it. You know, they do a real clean number on it and you don't know if there's oil leaks or there's problems. But if you can get a car and you can speak to the owners who are selling the car and they can give you genuine... And you'll hear from someone if it's a genuinely well-loved car. They're almost reluctant to sell the vehicle. And that's often a good indication, because they're going to be quite honest with you about what they've done to the car.
Yeah.
But even that, you've still got to take that with a pinch of salt, because the components you want to look at in a second-hand vehicle is you need to make sure that you've gone through the basics. So I call it an expedition service, where okay. You will do wheel bearings, you will do all the axle oils. On some vehicles, you'll pull the diffs out, you'll inspect the diffs, you'll put a new water pump in, you know, you'll check the radiators. So you're really going through the vehicle to make sure that you've got all fluids, oils changed, all bearings serviced, all belts changed, all hoses changed in some circumstances, depending on the age of the vehicle. And once you've got a baseline mechanical standard on the vehicle, you then know, as the new owner, then the next history of the vehicle. You know you've changed those hoses, you've never changed the oils, and you can work from there at maintaining the vehicle.
Mm.
So I've seen a lot of people buy vehicles and they've spent good money on a bad, you know, on choosing a really bad vehicle because they didn't look at basics. You know, there's simple things you can check or have checked. You can have compression tests done on the cooling system and you can have compression tests done on the motors. You know, that's important. You can lift up all the floor mats and look for rust. You can look carefully, really climb underneath the car and look carefully to see, are there any cracks anywhere?
You know? Big dents underneath means that it's been used and driven hard over rocks or
it's got a towage on the back, possibly that it's been towed.
Yeah.
You know, so then there's extra wear on the drivetrain.
Yeah.
So that's the key thing I've seen people make a lot of mistakes on, is they've chosen a vehicle which the basic condition of the vehicle is not great.
Mm.
So you need to have someone who really knows those vehicles well. A specialist in those particular vehicles, if you're going for a particular type of vehicle, someone who also knows overlanding. Because when you're buying a vehicle, you also want to understand what you're going to do with this vehicle. So while I may not pay too much attention to the seats being a little bit tatty, I'm really interested that the bodywork and the chassis is in really good condition.
Right.
And the engine sounds sweet.
Right.
And I can see that it hasn't had heaps of extra wiring wired into the car that you're going to have to spend good money taking out to put in a good system.
Right.
So I'm looking for abuse on the car.
Okay.
And that if you have the right person help you with that, you should hopefully buy a really good vehicle. Now you've got to ask yourself, are you going for diesel or are you going for petrol?
That was my next question was diesel, petrol, and then vehicle.
And why?
Vehicle type.
Right.
So let's go for petrol, diesel to start with. That's
Look, both are exceptionally good. I mean, some of the petrol motors are brilliant. They're thirsty. So, you know, if you're going to... And in some older vehicles, when you're looking to buy, I mean, some of the older vehicles that I've looked at in particular, I can find really good petrol vehicles available. And someone may not have the budget to buy a diesel. So we bought them a petrol. We put in bigger tanks. Their circumstances and their travel trips and their plans worked fine. It was a really good, solid truck. You've got to know you can get the fuel on your route.
On the routes that you're planning, that's obviously a critical one, yes.
And also, you know, you've got to look at problems you can have with bad fuel and things like that and sorting out.
But you can get bad fuel with petrol as well. So it's both.
You can't say. You can get with both. You know, and there's no... some of the petrol vehicles are really lovely to drive. They've got lovely power. You know, you can have a lot of fun in them. The biggest, I think, factor for people going for diesels is that, you know, it does give you more range in the diesel, and most of the big remote routes, you've got farms use a lot of diesel, you've got truckers driving trucks where they use diesel, so the chances of you needing fuel, but then we have to argue that most places, this is probably one of the remotest tracks you're going to do in the world, where you can't get fuel, or you've got to go and drive a long, you know, distance where you're carrying like 1,000 kilometers of fuel. So it is important to look at, and I think, you know, people have their preferences. In preference, I've always preferred the diesels.
Reliability-wise, is there anything significant? There's not
really. It does depend on some of the models, you know, and this is where, if you do enough research on the particular model or type of vehicle you're looking at, you'll soon find out the weak points. The internet's fantastic for that. You know, there's lots of shared advice. People are really generous with sharing advice about problems they've had or weak points. Every car is going to have a set of weak points. You just have to decide, you know, is that relevant to your situation? And more often than not, there's ways around sorting those problems out, you know, where they'll build new components or aftermarket components you can do to avoid that. So, Andrew, the other things to consider when you're buying a vehicle, you know, people don't restrict themselves to one continent. And more often than not, people look at shipping vehicles transcontinental. You know, you'll build a vehicle in Africa, You know, and you'll then ship it to South America and drive there. So your vehicle needs to fit into a container. And you do get two heights of containers. You get a standard container and you get a high cube container. And if money's not a cost, you can go for the extra high cube.
Yes.
But it's quite a problem when you've built a vehicle and you've put all the stuff on the vehicle and then you get to the port and now you've got to strip the roof tent off, the roof rack off, you've got to slip it in the side of the container, risk it damaging your vehicle. So it's a consideration when you're building your vehicle, what you're going
to
do.
I wanted to talk about trucks because I personally see all these very large trucks. And for me, a large truck is really desirable if the trip is very, very long.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're living out of it. But then when the truck gets to the point where it becomes no longer becomes, it gets too big,
so they,
then the restrictions are... They won't let you in game reserves,
national parks.
They just say no. Some of the most beautiful places that you have, you know, listed to view, they say, sorry, you can't come in.
It's very common in Africa. It's an amazing experience to have one of these all-kitted trucks. So in my experience, and I haven't owned one of the big trucks, but I've built a number for people and I've been involved in some of the bigger projects. And I've often said to people, my advice when they're trying to make that decision, do I go for a big truck or do I go for four-wheel drive with equipment? And I go, well, if you just take a simple cost expense, what it's going to cost you to build a big truck as opposed to building a four-wheel drive, which we're well kitted out, that difference in cost, you could put that money in your pocket and you could stay in some really nice little lodges along the way. So you're balancing out. You also find that a lot of people live in the vehicles. Now, in Europe and parts of South America, living in the vehicle is almost a necessity in some of the climatic conditions. Mm-hmm. So you need that. We tend to live out the vehicle, so we are much more inclined to interact with people around because you're not sitting in your vehicle, living in your vehicle like your home. So I found that, you know, in African good climate conditions, vehicles are built in a very much simpler way with a tent on top or a pop-up roof, and we live our kitchen area and shower area
outside.
All outside, which is great. It simplifies the whole cost structure and it also simplifies our needs. So you can't knock either, but as you say, highlighting the concept that when you're going to build a truck and you want to move it between continents, you've got to consider that there's a big expense. So it's an expensive option to do a truck, and I think those who can afford it do it really well and have some great trips. You're restricted in different areas.
Well, I did a trip in the United States last year, and we did Death Valley and ended up at Expo West with a great mix of vehicles at Expo West.
Nice, nice.
And there was a good portion, probably one-third of the vehicles on display at Expo West couldn't have done the trip because they were too big and they couldn't have done the passes that we went. And our vehicles were Toyota Tundra. It's a reasonably big pickup with a camper on it, and we squeezed through. But living in the camper was fantastic. And when we had bad weather,
it's fantastic.
It was wonderful. Yeah. Had we been in traditional SUVs with rooftop tents, we would have been 2 days miserable because it was so cold and rainy and horrible. We just climbed in, turned on the heater.
That's fantastic.
So that's balance.
Spoiled, really.
Oh, we were completely spoiled. So there's that's why my troop carrier is an attempt at a mix of small, compact, great off-road, and you can get in it when the...
Yeah.
But there are so few options.
No, I agree.
At that size where you can climb inside. And for that, you need a van.
So it's always...
And that's a challenge.
It's a compromise again. So the troop is one specific vehicle that you can do that. It creates a bit of living area. Equally, when you get up into, like, if you said to me, shipping that vehicle to Africa, you've got to consider security. And it's very hard to put security into a troopy when your living area is very open. So you've got access into the vehicle. So a lot of the vehicles that you build, that I build, if you're considering, and you would do in Africa, that you could take the rear half of the vehicle and turn that into a storage area where you'd store, you know, and you could make it more secure. So, you know, I think that's a very important discussion to talk about, and we will do that, about how you would lay out a vehicle. The most critical thing right now for us discussing this topic is that you buy the right vehicle. You know, and having a vehicle where you've got a cab and a load back on the back is a very practical solution because you get heaps of space. as an SUV, you know, where you've got
highly limited.
You're limited in, you know, you're creating everything as in one space. Mm. But once you separate the cab area from the load area, you can put canopies and stuff which give you a lot of extra space. So again, how many people are going to be in the vehicle? How long are you looking to travel for? How much space that you access in the vehicle is like very valuable real estate.
So accessibility then?
Accessibility
is limited in SUVs.
Yes, but it's the absolute key to overland expedition preparation on building a vehicle.
Right.
Because if you don't access it, you don't use it. And it becomes a real pain, as you know, when you're trying to look for something and you're unpacking three things to get to one. It's fine if you don't need it often, like spares.
Yes.
So in designing how you live in and around the vehicle, very few people give thought to, how am I actually going to live around this vehicle? Because if you haven't got that experience, and if the company you're working with hasn't got that experience, they'll bolt a whole lot of kit onto your vehicle. But they haven't given thought to actually, when you make your tea, where's the fridge? And are we going to be, where do we put our clothing when we stop at
priority, prioritizing access to different elements is therefore the key. Know what the priorities are before the build. So if you're taking a canopy, for example, a canopy top on the back of a pickup, which is a really, really good, practical,
it's great,
reasonably small size, but excellent access because you've got big, wide side doors. Yeah. Then look for a canopy that has full width side doors, not half width. Why half width?
Well, sometimes what they do with hard width. No, I'd say sometimes in hard width, it's not wrong because the big access doors give you that full space.
Mm-hmm.
But what if they get too big, you get a little bit of flex and then dust can creep in. But you can modulize it where you'll have a kitchen built into a canopy and that's slightly smaller, great access because you can get to stuff quickly. And then the other side, you get to your fridge. So, you know, I've recently built a few vehicles where we've actually had a small kitchen and a coffee maker, a little jet boil and coffee and tea and all that, a little table that clips on the side of the vehicle. I'm actually opening two of the little side locker canopies, access. I can get to my fridge and I can make my coffee. I don't have to open anything else. It's like when you need to change a spare wheel. You need everything in one place because you don't want to go and open the whole vehicle to get to stuff. So, you know, and considering as well, you've got to balance all this weight out that you're putting in the vehicle with the performance of the vehicle, the suspension you're putting on, and where you locate the weight to get the center of gravity so that that's not too high and keep it safe. So, you know, are newer vehicles better than older vehicles? Yes and no. I think, you know, some of the new vehicles that I've seen on the roads that we've used have got well-proven track records. I like to, for sure, if a new vehicle comes on the market, I like to let it wait at least a year or two to iron out any problems before I think of buying a vehicle of that nature if I'm going to do a big trip. You know, I know so many manufacturers that have released vehicles and in the first, you know, year, they're sorting problems out. That's normal. That's fine. We accept that. But you need to make sure that you are not buying a vehicle with those problems. You know, and so make sure you understand the weaknesses of your vehicle. Make sure you take someone who understands the mechanics of a good technician to help you check a vehicle through. Or pay someone, like the AA, I think they do a full test on a vehicle. And that's also worthwhile.
That's actually worth money very well spent.
Yeah. You say to the seller, I'm happy to pay for it. You take it, have the full test done. It's you know, it's a money well spent, worthwhile, before you, you know, go down the road of buying a bad vehicle.
Anything else we can think of to help people choose the right truck, vehicle, basis for their...
I think a lot of people rush into a decision with their heart. You know, you see a vehicle and you fall in love with a particular vehicle. I think you've got to realize that...
That's a good point. Yeah. That's a very good point because I believe that brand loyalty can be very... a tricky thing to live with.
Very difficult.
Because if you say, okay, I love Mitsubishis, therefore... I'm going to get a Mitsubishi. Well, then you might have to adapt what you do to that specific brand because you want that brand, whether it be Mitsubishi or Land Rover, Toyota, it doesn't matter. So because all of these manufacturers, not all will make a vehicle appropriate to your specific needs.
I think you can get away with most vehicles to make it work. The questions I'd be asking is, Can I get spares for this vehicle where I'm going?
Right.
Because that's an important part for me. If I have a problem, is the dealer network spread out well enough to give me that support that I need?
Okay.
So I want some dealer network support. Mm-hmm. I want to know I can get parts.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know that it's a well-proven motor or truck or that I'm using.
The basis, well-proven.
You soon know in the market that this truck is a reliable truck.
Mm.
They've sorted out the weak points, and it's a good, well-proven track record.
Right.
And that's key, and research is going to show you that. And if you talk to enough people who are in the industry doing trips, especially higher companies choose vehicles because they know these vehicles have got to work hard. So they're a very good indicator. They're going to buy a vehicle that's going to be a solid workhorse.
Yeah.
They don't want anything too fancy.
Their vehicles are going to be abused to a degree.
Absolutely.
So they must last.
So it's not that I'm always going to buy a higher vehicle off a company. Sometimes you can get some good deals. But more importantly, I know that those guys will have had the test record, the test bench. They have proven them. So it's often, go and talk to one of them. Ask them, what problems have you had on vehicles like this?
Mm.
They're the ones who are going to tell you, listen, this vehicle, and as I spoke before, tag-along tours, where people take a number of different clients on tag-along tours, they also learn what vehicles work, what equipment works.
At the risk of being, well, I am opinionated, and I accept that, and everybody must too, but I have certain strong feelings about overland vehicles and what they should not have. And, for example, as far as I'm concerned, if it has air suspension, it is unsuitable for overland travel.
Okay, and you have to ask yourself, why you're saying that?
Well, I'm saying that is because, A, when it fails, and one universal thing that all off-road overland vehicles will do, and that is their suspension will work very hard. It's universal.
Well, people punish their vehicles, and I think
Now what I'm saying is that the overland vehicle, if it's got air suspension, it disqualifies itself automatically.
Mm. So people fit air suspension to coil springs, so the air assist.
No, I'm not talking about air.
No,
I'm talking about electronically controlled air suspension, such as found in many Jeeps have it. The Touareg, Volkswagen Touareg has it. Land Rover Discovery have it.
We've got to understand these vehicles are built for a market, which is we don't fall in that market share.
Ah, but this is exactly why I'm bringing this up.
Yeah.
So overlanders, and we're talking 101 here, you're looking at these vehicles and you love this vehicle because you love the vehicle. I'm saying is, beware. Yeah. When a vehicle becomes highly electronic, particularly when it controls the suspension and transmission, it's starting to disqualify itself as an overlander because those are the things that are punished the hardest. And if they fail, they do fail, and they fail utterly. Mm. Your vehicle will stop and you will not be able to repair it unless you find a workshop. So to me, to help people select the right vehicle, I personally think that if it has electronic air suspension, it is disqualified.
It's something you're looking at a situation where you want people to have a good trip and not have these sort of problems. So, by actually ruling it out initially. Now, people have asked me often about automatic and manual, and I've built so many of both vehicles.
Mm.
And I think in the sand, the automatics are fantastic. They're gentle. Most drivers are too aggressive in the sand and they end up digging themselves in. And so I would never knock the automatics.
No,
but
no,
I would qualify that to say, you're going to be pushing those systems beyond what they're designed for with all the weight you're going to put in the car. So you absolutely need to consider things like, extra oil coolers for those gearboxes. And that's a very important point. And you also need to understand how to use those vehicles if you're driving up really steep hills and you're sitting in drive and the gearbox is hunting backwards and forwards as you alternate your speed. You're going to find that gearbox heats up a lot. It's a lot better just to lock it down into second gear and the gearbox will run a bit cooler.
So now you've brought up another subject, okay? Manual or auto?
Mm.
So you make some good points. So generally the answer is manual, but if it's auto,
I think
some things are to consider.
Absolutely. There's nothing wrong with building an auto vehicle, an auto truck.
Right.
You know, I think you can have as much fun on it.
But you need to know more.
You need to know more because you're going to find that very heavy vehicles, a manual gearbox down some steep descents, is going to give you a little bit more control. Whereas an auto box, you know, it doesn't quite hold the weight as well as a manual gearbox.
Yes.
It's a very small point. But you know, that said, equally, but you've got to understand the limitations, and also, you know, you've got to be very protective of that automatic gearbox. The sump on the automatic gearbox is quite a thin metal, and that can't take a pounding or a beating. You've got to, you know,
so not quite as robust as a manual, generally speaking?
I wouldn't say robust. I'd say my concern would be with an automatic that, you know, I've had clients who've actually cooked the automatic gearbox, the oil, and you can smell it, you know. And sometimes that's beyond repair, and sometimes they've just managed to change the oil, and it's been fine. You've got often very fine mesh sieves in the oil, and if you cook the oil in the gearbox, it can actually damage and affect that sieve, and then it doesn't get enough oil through the gearbox. But that said, if you look after the gearbox properly, and you are mindful of how to drive the vehicle, it actually is a very robust, strong transmission to have. However, if you have a problem somewhere, getting a specialist to fix it would be more of a challenge
than a manual.
Absolutely. You know, and if you've got oil coolers, you're running extended oil pipes to the oil cooler, there's a small risk that if you have a fracture, you could lose all your oil. So, you know, it's important that anything like that gets fitted. I've watched people fit oil coolers, and they've literally zip-tied it through the fins of the oil cooler onto something, and, you know, it's just not going to last because they haven't got the experience of driving on really rough terrain. They're probably a good workshop. They fitted lots of oil coolers, but not to overland vehicles. So, you know, any work or modifications that you're having done to the vehicle and upgrades needs to be people who actually understand where this vehicle's going, and they've got the experience to back that up, that they know why they're making these changes to the vehicle. And why, if your workshop hasn't fitted an overland suspension before, he's probably not the right workshop to fit it. Find someone who's done plenty of them, who really knows their oats. No, I think we've covered most. I think, you know, our key points are really for people to get the right advice, the right help, do the research. Don't buy with the heart, but, you know, take a sensible approach.
Not buying the heart is quite challenging.
It's very
particularly
hard.
The people that are brand loyal.
And I've had to do that to clients. I did that to a guy. And
many people are, yes.
He brought his Land Rover 90 outside, and it was a small vehicle. It was too small, really. It was perfectly capable to do the trip, but it was just too small. And I made him buy a Toyota Land Cruiser. He did all his overland travel. He came back at the end and he bought a new 90, because that made his heart happy. But he was very happy to drive the Land Cruiser all around his travels, because it was a much bigger vehicle. And he had choices, as we all do.
Well, to wrap this up, thank you very much for watching. I hope that we've been helpful and we've been constructive. And there'll be more overland workshops with Paul and I to come. If you'd like to support our programs and make sure we make lots more, support us on Patreon. Thank you for watching.
Thank you.